Michelle, you're tough, but, you know, you're a girl.
Girls turn into women who then change little boys' diapers.
Nice try. Nice recovery.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, Michelle, this is West Coast Project's review of Fargo, episode 2 in season 2.
Yep.
What did you think of this episode, Michelle?
I thought it was great. I thought it was, it took a couple of watches. This is some pretty in-depth material. It seems kind of deep, but I love it. What'd you think?
I think this Fargo is even better than last year's Fargo.
I do too. I do too.
So did you figure out the title, Michelle, Before the Law? It's actually a parable.
Jeez. You know what? I went to a website called genius.com, and I was reading about it. I'm not even joking. And there are, like, theses written on this, or I'm probably exaggerating that. But this, it's pretty in-depth, you know?
It's Kafka-esque.
It's some deep stuff.
So basically, it's the law being... The law can be interpreted as many things. Authority, like a courtroom, a place where legal people gather. But Before the Law is essentially a gatekeeper in front of this courtroom where if you can't even get past the gatekeeper, you'll never win your case. You'll never win over the other people and win other people's opinion.
Right. Well, you'll never even know what the law is or how it can work on your side or anything, right?
And I think the trick is that the philosophical struggle here is that the gatekeeper doesn't force you from entering. He just intimidates you from entering. So you think that his authority is enough to keep you from entering.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting.
And Kafka kind of says that as badly as the guy who wants to get past the gatekeeper may want it really badly, but he has to believe the gatekeeper will let him in. So it's, somehow it's a relationship between the gatekeeper and the person being kept out, and the belief that the person being kept out can never overcome that gatekeeper.
Yeah, and even, I don't know, part of the thing that I thought was so interesting in it is how the gatekeeper was taking bribes, essentially. And he was only doing it so he would feel like he had done everything he could. So the man would feel like he had done everything he could to get in, even though he told him that. So that was just a real interesting dynamic. It's like, I'll take this, but I'm doing you a favor by taking it. So you'll feel like you've done everything in your power to get through.
And further to complicate that the person wanting to get past the gatekeeper, he invests all the authority into the gatekeeper when he thinks he's like law-abiding and trustworthy. So if he's taking bribes, that kind of compromises that. It's super complicated. You're right. There are essays written on it, and that's just the parable. Like, how are we attaching this to this episode?
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't even know. Do you have thoughts on that?
No, I didn't even try. I'm struggling with the parable.
Yeah, I literally spent probably an hour trying to somehow relate that, and I never could even get a firm enough grasp on the parable in any kind of definitive way that I felt comfortable with trying to do anything else with it.
I thought this episode was great, though. It was 90 minutes long, for one thing.
I know. I wasn't expecting that.
It was super enchanting. It was just, like, mystical, almost. The music and the scene cuts and the sound effects. The wind was, like, sense-surrounding everything and the snow. And
I know.
It was beautiful with, like, a tsunami of dread waiting to flood in at any time. Somewhere, somehow, the dread is going to come and wash over this beautiful, melancholy scene that they've set up.
Well, Mike, that's very poetic.
Well, I think it is, right? It's like, what's this Kansas City group up to, and what's going on with the guy in the freezer and the relationship between Ed and Peggy? There's dread just waiting to pounce.
And has there ever been music more perfectly suited to scenes than this was, ever?
That's what I mean. It's perfectly... It's finely tuned. It's all synchronized perfectly.
Yeah.
I mean, what about Floyd? One of her sons is going to sneak up and kill her or something. There's dread everywhere in every scene.
Is that what he's going
to
do?
Well, he's going to not want to do what she wants to do, and she's claiming to be the matriarch, and she's in charge, and you can't have your control yet. Something's got to give there.
It's interesting to me how the Coen brothers, they really kind of take you back to the gender inequality of the 70s. And they take you back in a pretty hard way in this. It's kind of hard to watch.
Well, they paint Floyd, the woman, the Mother Gerhardt matriarch woman, as a really strong and capable character.
Yeah.
So one of these kids, one of these murderous kids, could be just murderous and not abide by civil, what we call, you know, the civil contract that you don't kill your mother and you don't do these evil things to your family members. But I think that's in store for her after watching this episode.
I thought he was just going to, like, get a vote, get somebody else on his side is all I thought. It didn't even dawn on me that he might do something physical to her. But after what we had just seen, right, I mean, I don't know why it didn't.
He agrees to her, and then he goes to his Indian buddy behind everyone's back and says, "Are you with me? Because this ain't going down the way they think it's going down." I don't know. I don't see good things for Floyd coming up.
No, but is she a bread baker or what?
She could get the jump on Dodd, though, and get him before he gets her. That would be kind of cool.
Yeah, there's no telling. There's no telling where this might go.
So we learned a couple facts here, Michelle. Floyd lost her first son in the Korean War. So her first son is not Dodd. That's a kid. That's a dead. First son's dead. Dodd's the oldest one now, but... And Peggy lost a fiancé in the Vietnam War. Did you know that?
I didn't catch that. No.
I didn't catch it in the show. I read it somewhere.
Okay.
So Floyd has another son, is not around. He was killed in the Korean War, and Peggy lost a fiancé in the Vietnam War.
Okay.
We also learn about this thing, Lifespring, that Peggy's involved in this group. It was founded in 1974. It's a nonprofit, New Age human potential kind of training group. And at the time, they had over 400,000 people in their training meetings. So it's pretty big.
Is it kind of like the Americans and what they're doing?
EST?
Oh, that's,
yeah, it sounds like it. I don't know much about EST or Lifespring, but it kind of sounds like it. Human potential, reach your potential. All right, so starting the episode, lots of meat close-ups here, Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
Almost pornographic meat. And the Kansas City boys, the Missouri boys, are headed to town down the dirt roads. Dirt roads in, what, 1989,
I think.
79.
Mm-hmm.
Dirt roads, though, that's pretty unusual. Because they're coming from far. They're coming from Missouri to Minnesota. That's a good haul.
Yeah.
And they drive right up to the Gerhardt HQ, and they meet with Floyd, the woman we're talking about. Everyone's kind of there greeting and giving condolences for Papa Gerhardt.
Yeah, Otto. Otto. Name Otto.
And they're just running that business from the kitchen table. Just a nice family business with kids running around and guys getting tortured in the barn. And
who was that? Do we know? Because I couldn't figure out who he had killed in the barn.
It was some guy that ran afoul of the Gerhardts. I don't know. I don't think we did know.
Okay. I didn't know. I mean, it was stunning to just, you know, mom's in there baking bread and getting the bankroll together. And there's even grandchildren running around. And, you know, Dodd's out in the barn killing somebody and cutting their ears off, feeding them to the dog.
Well, we see this kid who has some sort of a palsy. Who's that kid? We didn't meet him in the first episode, did we?
No, we didn't. That is, I think it's Bear's kid, but I'm pretty sure it's Bear's. I don't know why, but I think so.
He's helping his grandma with the payouts and the counting the money and stuff.
Right.
And Floyd requests, you go get your dad and your uncles. It's time to have a meeting, time to talk.
Right.
And Bear's there whetting his axe, just sharpening his axe on the porch.
Yep.
And, of course, we just talked about this guy, but Dodd and his Indian friend Hansi are torturing some poor schlub out in the barn. Dodd's bragging about his grandfather, who shot mustard gas at the World War I Allies, Michelle. So Dodd's grandfather was a German shooting at the Allies. Interesting angle. Of course, we hear a little bit about this immigration story of his grandfather. And maybe it was his great-grandfather. No, his grandfather, because it's her. It's Floyd's father, I think.
Yes, I think
shooting
so.
Shooting mustard gas at the Allies. And we see the guy getting tortured. He's dead. The palsy kid, you just said his name. What's his name?
Oh, I didn't. I don't know his name.
Oh, he comes in and says, Grandma's got a meeting. Everybody come in. And the dog runs up and eats the ears out of the bucket.
Yeah, but the grandson doesn't even flinch. He didn't even flinch seeing his uncle, we assume that's his uncle, out there killing somebody.
Well, it was actually Hansi doing the dirty work.
Oh, okay.
Well, it looked like Dodd was giving the orders and Hansi was doing the slicing.
Okay.
Business as usual, though. Probably happens all the time. So Dodd taunts the Kansas City guards as he goes past them. The Kitchens, the Kitchen Brothers, or their first name is Kitchen?
I think it's their last name.
Okay.
Yeah.
He kind of taunts them. Mm-hmm. Kansas City team leaves, and Floyd tells them about the deal.
Right.
Interesting that the Kansas City team only talked to Floyd. That Dodd didn't muscle his way in or notice that they were there, or he actually just allowed his grandmother, or his mother, I guess, to hold this meeting.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if he even knew they were there, because once he knew they were there, you know, he's out there like, I mean, he, what, like throws is it a cigarette or a cigar or something in their face or something?
Yeah.
He's very disrespectful.
So the deal is the Kansas City team wants to buy them out and keep them on as, I guess, showrunners of their empire.
Right.
And Bear's eating a donut or something and just slurps his milk. He seems like a kind of a dope.
He's not even drinking milk. Did you notice why he was drinking? He's drinking half and half. Half and half. He's drinking it from a carton. Anyway. What?
He's a healthy Minnesota farm boy.
Sorry.
And the offer seems like a corporate offer, and it's going to overtake the family business type of operation that they have. Like, the Kansas City boys want to make it corporate, and the Gerhards are a family business.
Right.
So Dodd just decides, well, so what we got is war. We don't want this deal, right, Grandma?
Yeah, but Floyd was like, she said, you know, we would end up maybe making more than we make now. You know, she didn't sound like, it didn't sound like it was too horrible of a deal to her, and she's the one who heard him talking. Of course, she didn't agree with it, but she didn't sound like it was a horrible deal.
Well, and I'll give Dodd a little bit more credit. The first thing he wants to do is know the offer. He wants to know the details of the offer.
Right.
But they do kind of say that we're going to turn it from more of a family business into a corporate-run deal, and Dodd just says, okay, so that means war. And Grandma doesn't want war. She wants peace and cooperation. I shouldn't call her Grandma, but Floyd. And she wants the deal to happen. It keeps everybody peaceful. And it's kind of the wise thing to do, I think.
Sure.
It might be the deal that you would put in the corner more of a woman making this kind of the smart, keep the family together strategy versus Dodd wanting war and let's bring everybody to war and overcome these invaders. And
right.
So she says, Grandpa's dead, and I think the palsy kid says, well, we'll do this until Grandpa comes back. We'll find out what happens, what Grandpa wants to do. And Floyd just lays down the truth here. Grandpa's probably done. He may never come back.
Yeah, she don't think he's going to come back and be able to run the business anymore.
So Bear supports Mama. Here's why I think Mama's in trouble. The Bear supports Mama and mentions some very mysterious connections to Winnipeg and the Selkirk gang, who we probably will learn about in this season, don't you think?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, or definitely hear more about, even if we don't meet them, yeah.
And so Dodd puts his foot down with the right of royalty in memorial, right? Like, I'm the oldest, so I'm the boss. I'm the heir to the king. And Mama wants to talk to Dodd privately.
Right.
And Dodd, interestingly, here, too, keeps his Indian buddy, Hamzi, in the meeting.
Right. He has Bear leave, his brother, but Hamzi stays there. What was that all about?
So why? Protection from Mama? Like a witness to what she says? Or it's just so he's better informed than he can... Dodd could remember and then tell Hamzi later?
I don't know. Or was it just like a slap to Bear? It was like, you know, you don't even get to hear. I don't know.
I don't think Dodd's a game player. I don't think he's a slapper. I think he's...
Well, there's some kind of game. Because why would he have him there?
Well, it's not to play games. It's strategic. It's not okay. Like... the next thing is sort of game playing. Is he moves to the head of the table. He pulls like a Tyrion. I'm going to the head of the table, not the side. Yeah,
right. He wouldn't even sit by his mother. I guarantee you. Well, I don't guarantee you, but I would think that would be like Otto's seat that he went to.
I think it was Otto's seat.
Yeah, that's how I took it. So
yeah, so Mama Floyd, though, is really powerful. She really comes across as powerful, but so does Dodd seemingly look powerful and kind of menacing.
Yeah, but I think he's bought what she said at the end of that scene. Did you? I think he's resigned to it after she talks to him.
What do you mean? Resigned to what?
She says, let me, you know, agree to the fact that I'm in charge until we get over this crisis. And once we're over this crisis, I forget the words she used, but essentially turn it over to you. You'll get your time and I'll focus on the grave or whatever she said, something real dreary like that. And Dodd just sits there. And I think Dodd is okay with that. And then we find out, because I mean, he doesn't balk at it. And
no, he's not okay with it, because 5 minutes after the meeting's over, he's telling Hamzi, are you with me? Because Bear's not with me.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. But that's what I said right then. I thought he was with her.
No, he's pretending he's fooling her. He's pretending to be with her.
Yeah, that's not nice.
Well, it's also not good. He's betraying. He's not saying, come on, Mom, here's why I really deserve this. He's appearing to agree with her to fool her.
Right. He's not standing up for what he believes in, you know, which you could respect. He's being underhanded about it. I completely agree.
So Floyd talks about how her father left the Weimar Republic and built an empire in the USA from a shoebox. It's kind of neat philosophy about how empires are bigger than the sum of all their parts, even if those individual parts are people, sons and daughters. It's the empire's bigger than the individuals.
Right.
So here's what she says. She says, your time will come, but it's not now. Stand by me and I'll hand you your legacy.
Right.
And she then asked Hamzi to go find Rai. And Hamzi gives her a lot of respect. He's like, yes, ma'am, right away. And he kind of leaves and looks like he's going to do that. But then a minute later, Dodd and Hamzi are conspiring against her.
Well, yeah, everybody wants Rai now. The Kansas City gang wants him because they want to get one Gerhardt in their pocket so they can go ahead with their deal. Mom wants him. Floyd wants him. And now Dodd wants him because Floyd wants him on her side. And Dodd wants him on her side. And, of course, the Kansas City people want him on their side. And I don't think Rye's going to be on anybody's side.
What did you think of the Kansas City gang, Michelle? How'd you like them?
Mike Milligan, was that his name? I love that character. What do you think of that character? And I even like the Kitchen Boys? I loved it.
They don't say much.
No, they don't.
Kind of like the wrench and what's the other guy?
Yeah, I can't think. But yeah, they're silent. And I can't believe I can't remember that.
So I like the leader, Brad Garrett, too. Joe Bulo says, people of Germanic persuasion don't surrender easy, but you can kill them.
Oh, I know.
And
yeah.
Mike Milligan says, let's make a deal with Mama. She's a woman and we can scare her. And Brad, I guess Joe, actually says, nope, it has to be one of the sons. So like you said, they're looking for the weak part of the family that can get in their pocket.
Right. That's why they're all going after Rye. By the way, it's Mr. Numbers.
Numbers and Ranch, yeah.
Yeah.
So Mike makes some sort of an analogy about the pincher claw and the crusher claw of crabs or lobsters. And
yeah,
Brad dismisses it with, like, which one is which? Which son is which part appendage? Pretty funny.
Yeah. Is that true, by the way?
Well, I don't understand the analogy either.
No, but do crabs have a pincher claw and a crusher claw?
Well, they must if Mike Milligan says that.
Well, there you go. He is wise.
So Brad, or I guess Joe Bulow, going to be calling him Brad Garrett. He dismisses it and says, we acquire with cash or we send bodies to the morgue.
Yep.
The first body to switch sides gets a shiny red apple. So the first one of those Gerhardts we can get on our side kind of gets rewarded for it.
Right. But they're not counting on anybody but Rye.
Yeah, for some reason, they must have investigated him and known that he's the greediest or the weakest.
Right.
Yeah. So that we can get a commercial, first commercial break.
Yep.
Come back to the Rock County Sheriff's Office, Michelle, and we get another goofy receptionist lady at the front desk. And Hank is there to view the crime evidence. Hank is Ted Danson.
Yeah, he's got the shoe on his desk.
It's a Cinderella shoe. If he can find the owner of that shoe, he's got his princess.
He sure does.
Size 9. Now he drives with really jaunty music to the Salverson house, and he wants some breakfast. He wants some eggs, but Molly's mom, Betsy, can't stand the smell.
Yeah. That's not good.
And, was it Lou telling the oyster story to Molly? Or is it, no, it's Hank, huh?
It was Hank, and good grief, did that conversation just throw you? We had Hank talking to Molly, and we had Betsy talking to Hank, and we had Lou talking to Betsy, and then Lou talking to Hank, and Molly talking to Hank. I mean, it was like, it was crazy, and I mean, it was like, they'd do like a little snippet of one conversation and then go into the other conversation. It was like, you know, Thanksgiving at my house, it was just crazy to try to keep up with that.
Yeah, but it was orchestrated well. It was understandable.
Oh yeah, it was perfect. It was perfectly done. But it was just, you know, the kids interrupting. She wants to hear the story, and Molly or Betsy's telling Hank about the judge, that the older woman that was killed was a judge, and then Lou comes in and he's telling him, and in the meanwhile they're trying to do eggs and oatmeal and. And, I don't know.
So just like the Soloway story, Michelle, in The Affair, that we do the podcast for The Affair,
yep.
Is an ugly little cuss. This Molly, little kid Molly is a cute little kid. So I'll give her the credit that I've taken away from the Soloway baby. Cause Molly is a cute little snipe as a kid.
Yeah, she's precious, but I disagree with you for the record about the Soloway baby.
So they have an extended oyster eating philosophy, almost as if it merits this major philosophical decision.
Yeah, what's all this shellfish talk?
I don't know, and in the Midwest, it's got to be mysterious food to them.
Yeah.
So Lou asked
about... We talk about clams a little bit later on. That's what Peggy says that Ed got sick on. So
it's a mystery food, and nobody can refute it. Like, oh, yeah, clams. I heard those are... like, I may never have had them in my life, but I heard they're hard on your system.
Okay.
So they Lou shows up and relates that one of the murder victims was a judge, and they start to talk about the judge. This judge, we find out, was from Fargo.
Right.
They're in Lucerne, Minnesota. So that's why nobody knew her. She was kind of far from her home base.
Right.
Although we don't really know why she's driving into Minnesota.
Right.
So smash cut now to the Corvair and some thrilling cello music and bells, Michelle. Bells again.
I heard the bells this time. I paid attention. I heard them at least 2 times, which is good for me.
And Fat Todd. Good God, that kid got fat.
Mike!
He is fat. If you can't call him fat, you have no position on this podcast.
You gotta be nice.
Fat. Fat Todd. Contemplating his tasks. Now, I'm going to give him a lot of credit because he's an excellent worker. So we have that split screen again, which is pretty cool, of him and then Peggy getting ready for her day. Ed's kind of looking around at the wallet. He's kind of contemplating what he's got to do here. They discuss Peggy's punch mark on her face.
Yeah.
But Ed does a great cleanup here. It's really good. He's a good accomplice to have in a crime like this.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he is. But he... Would you vacuum up bloody glass into your Hoover and then burn your clothing?
I think they made it appear that he was doing everything sequentially. Like, he wasn't messing the glass in the blood. He wasn't just sloshing bleach around everything. He was taking away as many parts of the crime as possible in the cleanest, most efficient fashion.
He was very methodical in what he was doing. And, you know, we have to remember he's a butcher, so he's got to know that kind of stuff. But I just, you know, if he's trying to really hide evidence, he is sucking up bloody glass into his Hoover vacuum cleaner.
All right, so he's going to get rid of the vacuum cleaner somehow.
Yeah.
He's got to get rid of the glass somehow. He can't pick up every little...
No, but couldn't you, like, sweep it and I don't know.
Well, he did. He swept it away from the blood and... I don't know. I think the message there is that he's being careful, as careful as possible.
Yeah, I think he's gonna get caught.
Okay. Well, here's where we see Dodd and Hansi. I guess they talk about, "Are you with me? The distributors will side with me. Let's go find Rye. Right. Or you go find Rye." And then another commercial.
Right. Bring him to me. Don't take him to Floyd. Make sure I talk to him first.
So Peggy shows up on a bus, Michelle, to the big city of Lucerne.
Man.
And this is where she goes in and tells about Ed's excuse for not being in that day, that he had some bad clams.
Yep.
At Lou's Meats. And they say, never trust anything that came from the sea. And yeah. Interestingly, Michelle from Tennessee, from the sea of Tennessee... The chick reading the book, is The Myth of Sisyphus, which is the next episode.
Oh, was it? I didn't catch that. Good catch,
and
Mike.
She says, we came from the sea. Pretty cool. Pretty smart that, listen, you dumb redneck Minnesotans, we came from the sea. So don't just say you can't trust anything that came from the sea. She looks like a super intelligent type to me. She's been reading all the time we've seen her.
She's a reader, yeah.
Oh, now who is she?
I think she's the butcher's son, the shop owner's daughter.
Okay. So Peggy, after going there, goes to her hairdresser job.
Yeah.
And her boss, I guess it's her boss, it's the owner of the place maybe, makes fun of her big night and hangover because she looks a little bedraggled, I guess.
Yep.
And she wants her to go to the meeting. And learn about the strategy. I guess this is the meeting of the group, the Lifespring people?
Yes, it is. Because she says, have you talked to Ed yet about us going next weekend or whatever? Yeah.
And so here we hear some more analogies of philosophy of what people are in life. Like your husband's needs. You're telling me your husband's needs are more important than yours? So she's kind of taunting her.
Yes, she really is.
And she says, you know what? We means a castle. And you know what a castle is? It's a moat with a drawbridge. And who's locked up in castles? Princesses. Take the seminar and you'll get the key to the castle. You'll be able to escape from this. And by the way, where's my damn toilet paper?
Yeah, and by the way, I'm missing a case of toilet paper. You don't know anything about that, do you?
Yeah, so that was pretty cool. She seems very smart, but then very simplistic, too.
I think she seems like an instigator.
Well, she's a leader. She's one who owns the business, and she's the one with the philosophy, and she's got the Lifespring.
She does.
She's leading the charge to Lifespring.
Yep.
So next we see Lou talking to somebody about the case, some superior, it seems like. And he's made plans to head to Fargo the next day. I think this is on the phone. He's made plans to go to Fargo the next day.
Yeah.
And we jump cut to the typewriter store with Mike and the kitchenettes now. Now, Michelle, that store blows. It's a mess, man. It's
not even open yet.
It's a ragged ass mess. It's got the ragged plaster, bare wood, crappy lights.
Yeah, why isn't the owner of that store, why isn't he in there in his overalls and his, you know, t-shirt in there doing some kind of painting and maintenance to the inside of the store?
Well, they seem like they are about to, maybe, because they have plastic over all the typewriters as if we'll protect them from the sawdust that we do in our, as we refurbish the room. But
well,
nothing's going on that in that direction. It's just the guy standing there at the counter.
Remember in the first one, though, the guy who was wanting the money? I think that guy was the one in there, you know, working on the refinishing. And he didn't get paid.
Okay.
So maybe that's why it's still like that. They're still showing us that he doesn't have any money yet.
It's a mess. I mean, even the way that guy's dressed with the plaid shirt and the bad ties.
Well, it was the 70s.
Mike is pretty cheerful, though. Mike is cheerful / menacing. He's looking for Rye. Gets that guy, puts his tie in the typewriter. And yep. Mike's motto is always, put it in writing, Michelle.
Yep.
So he types a few. He rolls his tie a little tighter. But that guy gets off easy. His tie's ruined, stretched out, but he gets off the hook.
Yeah. Yeah, they believe him.
There's a lot of close calls in this episode where things could have turned out worse a few different times for different people.
Right.
Or we'll go back to Fat Ed, Fat Todd. He's very good at cleaning.
Mike.
He's very thoughtful about that body in the freezer. And then we see him in his splendor of nakedness as he puts his clothes in the fire.
Every bit of them.
Puts his undies in there, Michelle, but not his triple striped socks.
Well, I guess you got to draw the line somewhere. I don't know.
All right, we get a commercial, and we come back to a really, really cool scene. Even though it's kind of a depressing scene, it's Kristen Milioti, Betsy, and her enchanting chemo treatment.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was terrible.
This scene is just simply beautiful. It's, like, strikingly beautiful. It's such at odds with what's going on with this woman and her treatment. It's beautiful. She's sitting there. She's at peace. And it seemed to me that she's so much at peace that her death won't even be sad. It's just like a plot sequence. Like she may already be dead, and we just get to enjoy a little bit more of her now while she's still alive. It doesn't seem like there's a big, huge, sad event to come down on this woman.
You know, I think it's because she is so brave. You know, she's like just carrying on with her life and talking about everything else. And she just has this, you know, just this will to continue on with normalcy is what I see in her. And I just see her as just the bravest of all characters.
But the message of the story is, too, that this is beauty. It's like peaceful beauty. And it's almost like the special time we have with her is bonus time that we weren't able to get with her in season one.
It's
just made to look peaceful. It's not made to look like she's brave and she's going to overcome and she's accepting.
No. Not overcome brave. Just brave in her acceptance, maybe, and in her life. And it is what it is.
Yeah, but they could have done that without the beautiful music and the lighting and... I don't know. It's just really cool. There's another message that this is somehow supposed to look beautiful. And I like, too, how the split screens they show are both horizontal and sometimes vertical. Sometimes they're over and under and side by side. Then they show a scene with Molly, Lou, and Betsy as a family. And it's almost like a philosophy lesson of how perfect a family is. Like, it's perfection in the moment. Like, be happy in the moment. Like, don't worry about what is to come, because we know what is to come.
Right.
What, when, and if. Those are all probably going to be unpleasant, especially...
Well, Peggy even says it. You know, she's like, aren't we lucky we get to have lunch with Daddy or whatever? I mean, just this joy radiating from that simple act. It was, you're right. That was beautiful.
And she knows that her end is near. She's feeling pain as she's building the snowman and stuff.
Right.
She knows clues are telling her.
She's weak. Right.
So we learn now, Michelle, what Lou heard in that call about Fargo. What did I put here? In that call, there's some chain of command bullshit. He says that to his father-in-law?
Hank.
He says that to his father-in-law, that there's some bullshit in Fargo. That's what he was talking about on the phone when we didn't know it at the time, when we just heard or saw his side of the phone call.
Right. Yeah, because she was a judge and from Fargo, he was kind of saying that they had to get involved too, right? I mean, he was like kind of opening it up because he said that it would be a mess if he didn't.
I guess they need the control of the Fargo people need to be in control of it because she was a Fargo judge.
Right.
But yeah,
is it the Fargo people or just more like, I don't know, like the FBI or something?
Well, he said Fargo. He said he's going to Fargo. I mean, unless there's an FBI office in Fargo. All right, so this scene, the beautifulness of this scene, I can't get over it because it continues. Now it's twilight, and there's like falling shadows and light as they go to this diner.
Yeah,
like the scene of the crime.
And they showed it from inside the diner, inside the unlit diner, outside into the dusk. It's not really dusky, but it's, you know,
yeah, it is kind of dusky, and it's frozen in time from the crime. Now everything is the same as it was during the crime.
And you can even see, like, the dust going through the air and stuff with the sunlight coming through. I mean, it's just, it was a great scene.
So Betsy asks Lou, why are we stopping before we get into the diner? And he says, just a wild hair. So there's some evidence and clues or hints, at least, about some sort of extra perception that people have.
Right.
Like Lou has a thought, a feeling, something's going on here.
Right.
That's pretty interesting. I wonder if that'll play out into more... something more solid that we can see.
Well, did you notice that what he was, I mean, he was talking about later on, he's talking about the cook and where the cook fell and the look on the cook's face, and he relates it to other things we'll talk about in a minute, but he picked up the bug spray. That's what he came walking out with. And do you think we're going to find out, since we've kind of questioned it all along about this judge, do you think she was into something?
Well, I mean, she needed a reason to think that she had to protect herself. That's one clue. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know why that was a thing. I thought it was cool, before we jump into what he sees in the diner, though, it was cool when he stopped there and he just says, I have a wild hair. Betsy just accepts it. She just trusts him and says, okay, I'll play with Molly. We'll make a snowman.
Oh, sure.
And she just goes out and plays with Molly. It's like, okay, well, I thought we were going to go home and have dinner, or I thought we were going to do what we were doing. But no, okay, we're going to stop for a while. Okay, we'll make the best of it. I'll make a snowman with Molly.
Sure.
And Molly promptly names the snowman Bob.
Right.
So now Lou gets the clues inside the diner. He sees the bug spray and says yeah to himself. Yeah, like something he realized.
Right.
And Molly outside, I don't know if these are connected, but they happen in this sequence. Molly finds the little Mylar balloon that says, get well soon. Pretty ironic with her mother playing with her like that.
Yeah. I didn't know if that was supposed to have some significance about the UFO. You know, like maybe some light on the Mylar balloon or something. There's got to be something more about that Mylar balloon.
I thought it gave Betsy a chance to say it, to do what she does next, and she says, "Oh, Molly, that's trash now." Right on the heels of watching her grimace as she kind of bends over and gets up,
right.
Like get well soon is trash. It's her reality. She's not going to get well.
Okay.
And then she finds the gun, but I think that might have been the message: is that I'm not getting better. It's trash now. It's wishful thinking, almost.
Okay, yeah.
And she doesn't have to say that to Molly with clarity. Molly doesn't know. She just thinks it's a piece of garbage. But that's maybe the more meaningful message.
Okay.
Now, it was interesting, the positioning of Rye's weapon versus the judge's weapon. Like, Lou has the judge's weapon, and Betsy finds Rye's weapon.
Right.
And they were both kind of standing there. That was really cool, I thought.
Yeah.
And as Molly tries to figure out what's going on, Lou just says, "Mama saved Daddy again," or something. And she says, "Go, Mama."
Yeah.
And it puts a cheerful face on her pain. Pretty cool. Pretty way to... It helped us escape a little bit from Betsy's pain of this, maybe realizing that she doesn't have much longer to live for. I don't know. The little cheerfulness made it a little better. And then that car drives by with the Kansas City guys, and there's that feeling again from Lou. So yep. There's something extrasensory here.
Yep. I think so, too.
All right, and then a commercial. And on that commercial, Michelle, American Horror Story. Are you still watching that?
Oh, my gosh, Mike. Have you seen that this year?
No.
Okay. One of my girlfriends on Facebook put up something about it, and she's like, okay, I tried to watch this episode one, right? And she put it up like 20 minutes into it, and she's like, I cannot watch this. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. And so, of course, what do? As soon as she says, I'm like, okay, so I got to go see what this is, right? Because she's really a smart girl. And, Mike, it was the worst thing. I mean, it was so bad. It was so bad. And I couldn't watch it. And how many times have you heard me say that?
Bad storytelling or gross out stuff or what? Why is it bad?
Yeah, there was no story yet at this point. You could make nothing out of nothing in the first little bit of it. But it was the most... Now, you don't hear me use these words a lot, but it was the most vulgar, vile, gross, gory stuff. I have, and I like zombie stuff, and I can watch, you know, all these history reenactment things and everything. This was horrible. It was horrible. I can't watch it.
More horrible than Fat Todd in the fireplace?
Oh, my gosh.
All right, Michelle, back to Fargo.
Okay.
Hank's blocking the road. Now, yep. I thought this was the end of Ted Danson. I thought this was the one of the jump in, jump out kind of... Ned Stark, you know, put the big star in for like one season, one episode, two episodes. That's the end of him. Because the way he's got this roadblock going and these three kitchens and two kitchens and Mike.
Yeah.
It looked bad for him.
It did. It looked
bad. Mike does all the talking from the back seat as the kitchens are in the front seat. And by the way, those kitchens are identical. Even though their overcoats were not the same color, they were the same style, and their pants were the same, and their sweaters or shirts under the overcoat were the same.
Well, they look exactly alike.
Their hats, yeah, they're like identical. Pretty funny.
Yeah.
Numbers and wrench all over again.
Yep.
All right, and very Rambo. Hank tells them, "You leave this state and don't ever come back again," like Rambo.
Yep.
And interestingly, Michelle, he's there because Lou called that in. When he saw that car and felt that feeling, he called Hank.
Right.
Called in a roadblock.
Yeah, and I kind of wonder what he expected Hank to do. You know, I mean, obviously he couldn't do it. He had Molly and Betsy with him, but I kind of wonder what he expected Hank to do.
Well, he checks the Cinderella shoes angle. What size are your shoes, boys?
Yep.
And he gets one... 7 or something and an 11.
Well, 110. Yeah, Mike Milligan says his is 10, and the other guys like flip him off. And so Mike goes, "Well, I guess that's 11 because if it was 2, they'd be toddlers." He's quite the talker, isn't he?
He's great.
He's great. And his speech, I kept listening to him, everything he said. And of all the things it reminded me of, and I don't know why, and I can't get it out of my mind, he sounds just like the kid in Home Alone. And I know that sounds crazy, but go back and listen. He sounds just like him in his storytelling and stuff, like as he throws out these little, stories that he's going through. And it's just, it's incredible.
Now, you're talking about Macaulay Culkin?
Yeah, I am.
Because Rye is his brother. Rye's a
Culkin. Is he really?
He's a Culkin, yeah.
Okay, seriously. 10 minutes. Watch 10 minutes of any of the Home Alone, but particularly the first one, and the way he tells stories, Macaulay Culkin, sounds identical to the way Mike Milligan tells stories.
Did you notice in the background of this conversation between Hank and these three that there was a chainsaw or a wood chipper?
No, I did not.
You could hear it in the background.
Oh, my. You're so good at that.
But this three-on-one ends peacefully for good for Hank. He gets out of it.
It's very ominous, though.
Now, yeah. In the next scene, is Todd following Peggy, or is that just a coincidence that he sees her?
I think he was just waiting on everybody to leave, and he happens to see her. That's how I took it.
Well, what's she doing?
She's leaving work.
So he knows where she works. Looks like he was watching her.
Well, he was definitely watching her, but maybe their shop closed last or something.
So he needs to make sure she's gone before he can drag the body into the...
Well, not just her, but everybody. He made sure everybody was gone. This town rolled up their sidewalks. There was nobody around. All the businesses were closed.
His pickup truck is glass mirror perfect finish. I know it's supposed to be an old truck, but it is like gleaming.
Isn't it perfect?
Even when he opens the tailgate and you see kind of the inside of the tailgate, it's a little bit dented up like you'd think an old truck would be. Mm-hmm. Even that part is like polished to like a glimmer. It's just beautiful.
Well, was it an old truck though? I mean,
it's probably a pretty current truck for then.
Right.
It's just beautiful. It's like they put a glistening glimmer of perfection on this whole episode of beauty surrounding all these other evil things.
I've got a daughter who's a truck fiend, and she was talking about it. She was talking about this truck. She's like, isn't that great? She's like, look at that truck. So, yeah.
But I thought when Peggy passed him that it seemed almost an accident. Like, I don't know. But he overhears the woman from the hairdresser shop say, come on, sexy. Like, she's Peggy's, friend who's a girl who's not a girlfriend?
Yeah, I don't know. That was weird. I think we're going to see more of that. But
the reason I thought it was spying is because then Ed drives a little further. Like, maybe it was just safe after they left. He felt it was safe.
But come on. I mean, he's got this bright orange truck. Everybody's going to see that truck. It's the only truck on the road. It's the only car on the road. Anybody would know it was him, right? But he wasn't sitting in front of the butcher shop. He was sitting on the other side of the road. So if people were looking for him, maybe they wouldn't look over there or something. I don't know. But all he did was turn his car on and drive to the other side of the road.
You don't think Peggy would notice her husband's truck?
Well, she knew he was there. Remember, she called him.
Yeah, I guess she would be okay to know he was there.
Yeah.
All right, Michelle, burger time.
Oh, my God.
Or at least ground beef. Eerie, quirky music while they do this.
Yeah.
There's a body in the butcher shop, and then we get a commercial.
Yep.
Okay, now Peggy comes home, and the song Kansas City is playing on the radio.
I know.
And her coworker's in there with her, and she needs to take a pee and finds the stolen toilet paper. That was kind of funny.
It was funny. It was fair that she looked, too, and I like that. She didn't just go through her bathroom. You know, there was nothing to dry her hands on, so she was opening the bottom under the sink to try to find a towel, presumably.
Yeah, she's looking for clues for that stolen toilet paper. Then she calls Peggy, you're a bad girl, breaking the rules. Like, she's flirting with her. She's hot for some Peggy action.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You know what that means, though? She'll be dead in two episodes.
Oh, okay.
And then they see the spotless car that Todd has cleaned up, the Corvair with the hole in the windshield.
Spotless. How would you clean up? I know. How would you clean that up around the broken glass in the hole?
Well, first what you do, Michelle, is you sweep it. Then you vacuum it. Then you bleach it.
And then you burn your clothes.
Exactly. All right, jump to Hank and Lou talking. Lou with his rope knots. This is nervous affectation. He ties a rope into knots, unties it. And he tells us the cook fell funny, like you said. Like you said, Michelle. The cook fell funny, that's why I'm here. And Hank says, do you want to talk? And Lou says no, but then he starts talking. Pretty interesting the way they communicate.
Yeah, I kind of thought for a minute he was asking him if he wanted to talk about Betsy.
He does.
Is that what he was asking?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It's like you want to talk about anything, and whatever comes out, I'll listen to you.
Right.
Because he probably has a lot inside about Betsy.
Sure.
But he does talk, but not about Betsy. He talks about a cigar guy in Vietnam who got picked off, shot right in the cigar.
Yep.
And the look on his face when he got shot was bafflement, just like the cook.
Yep.
So how was that a clue?
Yeah, I don't, I didn't get any, I didn't get it. I didn't get anything on that. Just something telling him that something was off in there. But I mean, the cook, we saw what happened. The cook come running out with his fry pan above his head and got shot. There wasn't anything that I could see that would, you know, be weird about that, right?
Well, it's after the fact. He did have a baffled look on his face after he was dead, laying on his back. He did look kind of goofy and baffled. But I don't know why that's a clue for Lou.
Yeah, I don't either.
So Hank tells his story of a suicide, just like Germans in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I got the feeling I got from this was that it's really sad that these guys have to face this evil in Lucerne, Minnesota. Like if you make your way through a war, you should come home to safety. It's like you make it through the worst of a war, you've made it to a place that should be safe for you.
Right.
Not crimes and people shooting and killing each other.
Well, Hank is calling it a callback. And I don't know if that's going to come back to us in some way, but he keeps, or he says the word anyway, callback. We call that a callback, something that brings you back to something just based on something that you notice. So
I think Hank may want Lou to talk so he can talk.
He may.
Like, do you want to talk? Because he wants to talk. He's exchanging these war stories.
Right.
And then he blames these present crimes that they see on the soldiers bringing the war home with them.
Yeah, his on Lou's soldiers.
Yeah, the
because
Vietnam.
Because he said, right, because he said when they came back from World War II, that there hadn't been a murder in years or anything until the Vietnam people started coming back, the Vietnam soldiers started coming back.
Right. So then we see a scene of Hansi driving, just by itself, real short, and then that's it. And it made me wonder why, because it didn't really show anything more about it. And we can jump back to Fat Todd grinding up some more.
You have got to not call Ed Fat Todd. That is awful.
All right, Fat Ed, sorry.
Oh, my gosh.
Then Lou patrolling hears some bells. So, Michelle, do you think bells mean bad decisions are being made?
Well, do they? Because they were playing bells when Ed was cleaning the garage and cleaning up the blood. I don't know.
Yeah, his decision to make the...
To clean it up, to be
a conspirator in the crime. I think I heard that on Bald Move. Bald Move has a good podcast on this show, and I think I heard one of them say that that might be a sign that bad decisions are in process. But anyway, so we have a commercial. We come back to Lou in the butcher shop, and Lou wants bacon for little Molly. Lean bacon, Michelle, not fatback.
Well, right, yeah.
Now, he crosses in front of a store next to the butcher shop called Mike Zoss Pharmacy. That's the same store as in No Country for Old Men.
Oh, is it really?
In the Mexican town where they go to get the pharmacy to get the medicine.
Oh, that's cool.
And Anton Chigurh goes into a Mike Zoss and steals the stuff that he fixes himself up with.
Yep.
All right, Michelle, now I'm going to ask you, because you're an expert on this cleanliness. Burger grinding is not good for sterility of that equipment when they're done with rye. There's going to be traces of rye in that machine for years.
Traces of rye. That sounds really funny considering that rye is like a grain. But, you know, I had this exact same conversation with my husband about how that just completely sets off like my germ neurosis. There's no way you could get that machine clean. They're going to be feeding pieces of rye to the community for weeks probably to come. No, that's horrible. They'd have to autoclave that machine, and I don't know how you would do that with its mechanisms and gears.
Yeah, it's got a million tiny angles and gears and.
That was hard to watch.
And then we see a comical finger chopping.
Yeah.
A near miss for Ed, but he gets away with it. And he has a nice oatmeal breakfast waiting for him at home.
Yes, he does.
He's probably happy.
That's the second time we've heard about oatmeal. We're hearing about, like, shellfish and oatmeal.
He's probably happy just to have a nice, clean oatmeal meal and not a, after all that meat and blood and gristle.
Just yeah, some I don't nice think oatmeal. Meat. Yep.
All right. Now, the episode ends with the War of the Worlds, the coming of the Martians.
Yep.
Did you have any more on that? I want to steal your thunder.
Well, you know, as they panned out of the butcher shop, it looked almost like a UFO going up as they were telling this. Did you notice that? It was like these blue lights again and something like going up the side of the building and everything. And they're doing that as they're telling this H.G. Wells, you know, story. And I don't know what they're doing with the UFOs. What's up with that?
It's the beginning of the War of the Worlds story by H.G. Wells, book one, chapter one. And it's about how the world's being watched keenly by intelligences greater than the humans that that inhabit Earth. They're watching over Earth. And that while men on Earth busied themselves with various concerns, that they were scrutinized by these outside Martians. Just like a man might look at through a microscope at a germ or something.
Why pretty do we interesting. Keep having these, yeah, why do we keep having these Martian, you know, nods?
I don't know, but like Kansas City's looking at Minneapolis or whatever, in Lucerne, Minnesota, for scrutinizing them to maybe take them over. Peggy's scrutinizing her life with her life group meeting to maybe improve her life. I don't know. It's hard to find the references to outside greater intelligences scrutinizing lesser intelligences in an environment that they want to take over.
Yeah, I don't know.
What else? What else would there be? The mama taking over the crime family now that Otto's gone? I don't know.
Yeah, but she's not a greater intelligence than Otto, I don't think. I don't even think she would say she was. I don't know. I don't yet get the all of the UFO reference that we're getting.
Well, it's the chapter subtitle is The Eve of War, so it's on the brink of something violent happening.
Right.
I don't know. Pretty thoughtful. You have to be pretty insightful to get it, I guess. Maybe somebody smarter than us will get it.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too hard to find somebody smarter than me in this, but yeah.
They do say something kind of interesting at the end of the little... There's a little story about this chapter in The War of the Worlds. I'll read a little bit of it. It says, one night the first missile could be seen 10 million miles away. I went for a walk with my wife. It was starlight, and I explained the sign of the zodiac to her. There were lights in the windows of the houses as people went to bed. The sound of the shunting trains ringing and rumbling softened into almost a melody by the distance. My wife pointed out to me the brightness of the red, green, and yellow signal lights hanging in a framework against the sky. It seemed so safe and tranquil. And that's almost how they made this episode, with Betsy's treatment for her cancer. And the diner with all this violent murder seemed pretty beautiful and peaceful. It's like a calm before the storm. But they're attaching this connection to the War of the Worlds. And I don't know. Maybe just...
Yeah, even a calm during the storm. You know, because when you have cancer, that's certainly not before the storm. And, you know, there's already been a storm in that diner. But finding the beauty in the midst of the storm, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you could read this and just so cool. It's like how man is vain and blinded by his vanity. That's no country for old men.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so that's it for Fargo Season 2, Episode 2.
Yep. And the upcoming episodes, Vague, Man, Fargo, Turn Loose Something, Give Us Something. They don't give us anything about what's coming up. I mean, they are like literal 1.5 second little quips of something that you can't tell anything about.
Next is Sisyphus, the guy who rolls the boulder up the hill every day only to have it roll back down, and he's doomed to do the same thing. And the girl reading the book, The Myth of Sisyphus, so maybe she'll have some more to say in the next episode.
Maybe she will.
All right, Michelle, how do people reach you if they have comments about the show?
Love comments on Twitter would be great, at Michelle from TN.
And I'm at Scathing Tweets. So until next week, Michelle, that's it for West Coast Project and our review of Fargo.
Okay, Mike.
See you then.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.